Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From Ferguson and elsewhere today, the long-term economic lessons from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, today the 26th of November. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. It can be a difficult thing to find and pull the economic threads from a story like what happened in Ferguson, Missouri. But Marketplace's Adam Allington has been in Ferguson since the grand jury's decision was announced, and he says those threads are there if you know where to look. We've got him on the line now from St. Louis. Hey, Adam, thanks for coming on.
Happy to be here.
Tell us, first of all, what's going on today. What has been going on today after everything that happened last night?
So far today, things have been fairly quiet. People are out waiting at the bus stops, going to work. Businesses, some of them are open, others are boarded up. There was a steeply ramped up National Guard presence in Ferguson last night, and I think that helped tamp things down a little bit. But going forward, I really think you're going to look at, you know, continued unrest of one stripe or another through Thanksgiving.
Play it out for me a little bit farther than that. I mean, it's been a rough 3 months for the city of Ferguson, for that entire area. What happens then with the economic redevelopment of Ferguson, as you talked about yesterday on this broadcast?
You know, Kai, Ferguson in many ways is really a good poster child for a lot of the economic problems of St. Louis. Ferguson is a, you know, an outlying suburb, somewhat bigger than most suburbs around St. Louis, and it has a somewhat developed downtown business district. Many of the business owners that I spoke with remain committed to Ferguson. They're going to keep their shops open. There are people milling around. And I think all of that's going to continue. And eventually, a lot of the chain stores, the Quick Trips, the Walgreens, et cetera, that were damaged or burned out, you know, those are going to reopen or open as something else. So I think the economic future of Ferguson is going to continue. But what I think the riots really underscore is the broader economic story of St. Louis, which is really how to build shared economic prosperity.
We should actually at this point say that you spent 8 years in St. Louis working for St. Louis Public Radio as a reporter. Give me that context then. I mean, where did this come from other than the immediate obvious cause, and then where does it go?
Yeah, you know, Kai, it's really all about economics. I mean, look at a map of the suburbs of St. Louis. We're talking 91 municipalities. It looks like a broken pot. And the history of how that was created is really a history of economics, that it was set up that way specifically so municipalities could capture tax revenue and avoid providing services to poor neighborhoods. So what that's done is really created pockets of prosperity amid extreme poverty. And going forward, that's what St. Louis has to wrestle with. That's what the suburbs have to wrestle with. They have to figure out how to unite into one shared economic future, because if anything, what Ferguson has done is shown you can't build your regional economy with so many people who aren't vested in its future success.
Find the hope for me in this whole thing, man.
One thing that I cling to is that I think St. Louis needs to come to grips with its history of racial discrimination, its history of redlining, its history of really bad civic leadership. And I think they know that. I think the world knows it. And I think going forward, a lot of the economic investment in downtown St. Louis, the shift away from a manufacturing economy into healthcare, into biotech, I think that bright spot in the region's future will continue. And I think a lot of these problems that we've been talking about will gradually get fixed. That's my hope, is that it'll get better going forward.
Adam Allington in St. Louis for us. We should tell you, by the way, that Adam took a video of Ferguson this morning. He drove through just to show you what it looks like. It's on our website, marketplace.org. Adam, thanks a bunch.
Happy to do it.
There is, as Adam was saying, a whole lot of work to be done in Ferguson. Rebuilding trust between citizens and law enforcement, yes, but rebuilding businesses and the economy, too. And that's one of the questions, right? One of the long-term questions. How will Ferguson's economy be affected? Not just now during the holiday season, but a year from now or 5 or even 10 years from now. Marketplace's David Weinberg has this look at the economic after effects of the much bigger urban riots in this country 50 years ago. Here's David.
It's just after sunrise in a park in south central Los Angeles when I meet Fred Tarvin. He works as a security guard at the Watts Towers, an otherworldly sculpture made of ornate spires nearly 100 feet high.
My thoughts when I first saw the towers as being a young man fresh out the service, I thought it was just a piece of junk.
Today, Tarvin, who grew up around here, has a different opinion. He calls these spires a mighty work. But most people familiar with the name Watts know it not because of these towers, but because of riots that burned much of the area nearly 50 years ago.
A lot of people didn't want to come over here because they figured that Watts is just bad because it got a bad name.
Watts struggled to recover economically after the riots, and it wasn't alone. Severe rioting erupted in poor black neighborhoods in Newark, Washington, D.C., Detroit, and other cities in the 1960s. Two economic historians, William Collins and Robert Margot, studied owner-occupied housing to see how much of those cities' economic declines could be attributed specifically to riots.
The severe riot group, depending on how we look at it, property values in these areas fall by about 10%. Relative to where we think they would have been in the absence of a riot, or in comparison to places that had much less severe, much less severe riots or no riots.
Collins says property owned by blacks saw values drop by as much as 15%. But what was most surprising was that these losses lasted through the 20 years they studied. Some cities still haven't recovered.
And a question that's especially relevant in the wake of an event like a riot is, does the place bounce back quickly from this? And if it doesn't bounce back quickly, why not?
The reasons are complex. Many of these neighborhoods were poor before the riots, and each place has its own circumstances. But there are common experiences after a riot. Insurance rates go up, cities tend to spend more on police and fire protection, and people who can afford to move away often do.
So if your tax base is being diminished at the same time that you're increasing demands for police and fire and things, this is the sort of stuff that investors might think of as potentially weakening the fiscal position of cities.
This makes it harder to raise money for revitalization projects. It's harder to attract businesses and developers, and news coverage can paint a negative picture of a place. The 60s riots were dramatic and catastrophic, says Collins co-author Robert Margot.
The events in Ferguson don't rise to the same level of severity that we saw in the 1960s. So that would lead you to suspect that they wouldn't have any long-run effect.
On the other hand, says Margot, the riots of the 60s lasted only days, whereas the unrest in Ferguson has gone on for months. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
Wall Street on this day before Thanksgiving was quiet, but in a buying mood nonetheless. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. John Deere and Company, the world's biggest seller of tractors and harvesting combines, said today that next year is going to be a tough one. The company is figuring to sell fewer of those big machines thanks to a slump in crop prices. Nova Sappho reports from Chicago that Deere's fortunes are very much tied to those of its farmers who right now are in the bust part of a boom and bust cycle.
If you've got $270,000 lying around and are looking for some new wheels, do I have a sweet ride for you?
Imagine a cab that's as big as you need it. Modern controls with touchscreen and video.
Okay, you probably realize we're talking about farm tractors here. And John Hawkins of the Illinois Farm Bureau says many of his members have had money to spend.
A lot of farmers were flush with cash and they traded for new equipment.
That's thanks to increasing demand from emerging markets, especially for corn and soybean, as well as fuel emission standards that required more corn for ethanol. But now there's an oversupply, and prices have already dropped by 50%, says Hawkins.
Now they're going to keep that combine or tractor a year or two longer than they probably thought they would.
And that's trouble for John Deere, which expects U.S. farm equipment sales to drop as much as 30% next year. Kwame Webb is an analyst with Morningstar.
If you say that this is a bust, then they believe that the forecast that they've put out there represents pretty much the worst of the bust.
And Lawrence DeMaria of William Blair & Company says John Deere will have little choice but to wait out the downturn.
Certainly when it is a cyclical company and the farm economy is cyclical, and when things turn against them, certainly they're susceptible to those declines as well.
John Deere is also a victim of its own success, DeMaria says, because it did a good job in taking advantage of the boom cycle. In Chicago, I'm Nova Safo for Marketplace.
There are days in this job, believe you me, when you look at a story and you say, wait, no, come on, we have got to talk to that person. So it was with an article on Bloomberg today, the headline of which read, "Shorting Chickens Becomes Hot Trade." The mental images alone are priceless, but there are actual market economics behind it. Bloomberg's Megan Durison shared the byline on the piece today. Megan, it's good to have you here.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
First thing I think we have to do here is explain the concept of short selling, yes?
Okay. So when an investor is short selling a stock, they're pretty much borrowing the stock from their broker and selling it again on the market. And so their assumption is that prices are going to go down and they're going to be able to buy the stock back for cheaper. So pretty much shorting a stock is a bet that the stock price is going to go down.
Okay. Now, why are people shorting the companies in this article, these two chicken companies?
Yeah, absolutely. So it seems like the short interest in both Pilgrim's Pride and Sanderson's Farm has gone up substantially since the end of September. And this year, chicken prices have been on the rise. There's been really tight supplies of both beef and pork, so that has pushed the demand up for chicken a lot. And those companies are both making excellent profit margins right now. Feed costs are really low and chicken prices are really high. But production is expanding and is going to be expanding further in 2015. So some people are speculating that maybe the rising supplies of chicken is going to be pushing the price of chickens down.
Could we say then that we are at peak chicken?
It's hard to say. You know, next year, red meat supplies, at least for beef, are still going to be really tight. The U.S. cattle herd this year started at the smallest since 1951, so more than 60 years, and beef output is just going to shrink further in 2015. But we might be at the peak. It's hard to say.
We are eating ever more chicken in this country, right? I mean, it's like billions and billions and billions of tons.
We are. Next year, production, the USDA forecast is going to be a record 39 billion pounds.
Wow,
so that's
yeah.
A lot of chicken. And that's, to put it in relative terms, that's about 65% more than either beef or pork output here in the U.S. So we produce a lot of chickens. And relatively for per capita availability, there's about, next year, there'll be about 85 pounds of chicken per person here in the U.S.
Wow.
So it's a lot.
What happens on the consumer end of this thing? I mean, eventually, if these short sellers are right, and if we're at peak chicken, then eventually chicken prices go down.
Yeah, that's, you know, the wholesale prices and retail prices don't often move exactly hand in hand, but consumers certainly could see cheaper chicken next year. And also beef prices this year, especially on the retail end, have just been surging. The USDA is predicting them up about 11 or 12%, and so that's much more than the gains in chicken.
Megan Durison is a commodities reporter for Bloomberg. She is based out of Chicago. Megan, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Coming up.
It really is kind of reminiscent of, you know, chestnuts roasting on an open fire and having that great chestnut taste.
Yeah, I bet it is. But what happens when companies co-opt your holiday traditions, But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials cranked up 12 points today, less than a 10%, closed at 17,827. The NASDAQ climbed 29 points, that is 0.6%, finished things at 4,787. The S&P 500 added itself 5 points, 0.25%, 2,072. Hewlett-Packard clicked up 4% today despite worse-than-expected fourth-quarter sales. Analog Devices chipped up 5.5% today. Fourth-quarter sales for that semiconductor maker beat expectations. Deere dug down almost 1% today. We told you why. Construction equipment maker Caterpillar crawled down 0.4%. Lower energy prices hit some energy companies. Offshore drilling company Seadrill tumbled more than 18% today. Suspended dividends as well due to weaker demand for oil rigs. Bond prices rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.24%, and you're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. Markets are closed for Thanksgiving, giving you time to cook and make that extra run to the store for cranberries. According to the Census Bureau, the forecast for cranberry production this year is 856 million pounds. Please do your part and eat some. 50 million people blob out in front of the TV to watch the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. And rock legend Jimi Hendrix was born in Seattle on tomorrow's date. He would have been 72. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I know it's only been three short days, but this has been a big, long week for air pollution and the regulation thereof. On Tuesday, the Supreme Court agreed to hear a challenge to limits that the Environmental Protection Agency had put on things like mercury that are found in emissions from coal-fired power plants. The energy industry wants the EPA to take into account the costs of regulation before it decides to regulate. Then today, the EPA proposed a new rule that would lower the amount of smog-causing ozone that's allowed out into the atmosphere. That rule had been delayed 3 years because of concerns about the cost of regulation. That makes it two for two, so we asked Marketplace's Stan Alcorn to look into just how the EPA weighs those regulatory costs against the clean air benefits.
When the EPA sets a limit on a pollutant like ozone, it calculates the costs, but it only really cares about the benefits to health. Here's EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy talking about that lower ozone rule.
We are talking about 750 to 4,300 premature deaths avoided, 320,000 to 960,000 asthma attacks among our kids.
At $6.3 million a life, the EPA says those health benefits are worth up to $13 billion. But on the other side of the scale are the costs of cleaning up the power plants. Here's Howard Feldman of the American Petroleum Institute, an oil industry trade group.
There are extra costs for, let's say, a bolt-on scrubber that somebody would have to put on their power plant. There's also a cost for people changing fuels.
The EPA says those costs add up to $3.9 billion. The oil industry group, on the other hand, says it'll cost in the hundreds of billions, with ripple effects including the loss of 2.9 million jobs.
Those estimates are totally implausible.
Richard Revez is a professor and cost-benefit expert at NYU.
You know, 100 regulations, each killing 1.5 million jobs, would make virtually the whole country unemployed. And that's just not the case.
Which is a good thing for the EPA, because it's not actually legally allowed to take those costs into account when it sets the ozone limit. Instead, this whole argument over costs and benefits is about winning in the court of public opinion. I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
Staying with energy-related news, OPEC meets tomorrow. Oil prices and production levels will be right at the tippity-top of their agenda, and there isn't a whole lot for the cartel to be thankful for along those lines. Never mind that it's not actually their holiday anyway. Crude prices have been falling and hard, down another 40 cents today to $77 and change a barrel. And there is some chatter out there now that what with all the new U.S. production online, OPEC's best, most influential days are behind it. True? Not true? From the Sustainability Desk, here's Marketplace's Scott Tong.
OPEC on the wane? Analyst Bob McNally at the Rapidan Group has argued that for a while. In his view, it would be the third cartel-type group in history to peak and then decline. The first?
John Rockefeller and Standard Oil in the late 1800s, who came along and thoroughly, some would say brutally, organized and controlled the pipelines, the refineries, and then the upstreams. And he brought stability to what was in the beginning wildly gyrating prices.
Of course, trustbusters broke up Rockefeller's company. And then came Cartel 2.0, the Texas Railroad Commission. Starting in the 1930s, it pulled various levers to control prices. The key was having so-called spare capacity. When prices rose and threatened to turn away consumers, the commission brought more oil to the market and softened the prices. But by 1972, supply tailed off. There was no spare left.
What that meant was we were losing our ability to control the global oil price and to stabilize the market. And that signified the transfer in power over to OPEC.
Over to OPEC. Now they controlled supply and price. Some of us remember OPEC's Arab members cutting off the U.S. in 73. Analyst Jamie Webster at IHS Energy says a big moment lately came when OPEC withheld more than 2 million barrels of oil from the market every day. That was 2008. And that boosted prices quickly. Still, he says the world has changed. For one, embargoes are history.
The oil market has turned into a real global, truly global interconnected market. You can't just pick a country and say we're not going to deliver oil there. Somebody else will.
And many OPEC members today are drilling much less oil. In the meantime, a competitor showed up. Fracking in America coaxes oil from shale rock. And shale oil has helped push today's prices down. And the more they fall, the more likely shale could tail off and bounce the prices back up. In other words, we, the U.S., may be the new price controller.
This massively undermines the OPEC nations.
That's Ian Bremmer at the Eurasia Group. Now, low prices hit all sellers, but Bremmer knows that OPEC members like Saudi Arabia, they rely much more on selling expensive oil than the U.S. does.
And the Saudis are trying to fund, places like Egypt and Jordan to maintain stability in the region, so they can't really afford to try to drive prices down to compete with American producers. And so that means that the United States is in the driver's seat, right?
Right. Well, let's check in with some non-Americans. Robin Mills at Menar Energy in Dubai is calling hyperbole. He spoke by Skype.
I don't think we need to talk about anything like a new pricing order. There's certainly no kind of grand scheme behind this. It's the simple working of the market and of economics.
As he sees it, this is just another bout of low prices, which key OPEC countries can weather.
They still have enormous sovereign wealth holdings that they can draw on for years to come to prop up a deficit. And of course, they can borrow. I mean, there's nothing magical about borrowing.
And nothing new about a new supplier on the block. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Whether you've started your holiday shopping or not, or have been listening to Christmas music or not, however it is that you mark this time of year, we are going to spend the next month or so on the stories behind some of the holiday traditions we are all so familiar with. We're calling it Holidays, brought to you by
Imagination.
Wonderful products.
Brought to you by...
All right, so roll the phrase new tradition around in your brain for a second. It's kind of an oxymoron, yes? Yes, except when it comes to the holidays, because corporations are great at inventing new traditions. Think Black Friday and Cyber Monday. Here's another one, seasonal flavors. Sam Harnett has that story.
I'm at Starbucks and just paid $4.75 for the company's first new seasonal beverage in 5 years.
Grande chestnut praline latte for Sam.
It's got whipped cream, a crunchy sweet substance sprinkled on top, and chestnuts, right?
No, there's no actual chestnuts in it.
Linda Mills is a PR rep from Starbucks. She says the drink took 2 years of R&D, and it was the most liked flavor by test customers. While it doesn't have chestnuts, it does have smoky chestnut flavoring. That, along with caffeine, sugar, and fat, make for a holiday mix that packs a whole lot of nostalgia.
So it really is kind of reminiscent of, you know, chestnuts roasting on an open fire and having that great chestnut taste, along with, you know, our world-class espresso and latte mouthfeel.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire.
Food marketing people are trying to take advantage of those warm, fuzzy feelings, and they've been very successful.
Marianne Drake is a food scientist at North Carolina State University. The secret, she says, is in the scent. These aromas trigger emotions and feelings. In the last 5 years, Drake says scientists have made huge steps in understanding how scents affect us neurologically.
There was a study where they actually, forgive me for being indelicate, hooked up men and their private parts and then had them smell particular things to see which evoked the best response from their private parts. And pumpkin pie spice had a really strong response.
Oh, pumpkin. Drake says it kicked off this modern holiday flavor craze about a decade ago. For instance, Starbucks has sold over 200 million pumpkin spice lattes since releasing it in 2003. And now everybody's doing it. Have you been to Trader Joe's lately? Here we have pumpkin ice cream. Pumpkin ale. Ooh, pumpkin rooibos tea. Salad with pumpkin seeds and pumpkin croutons and pumpkin vinaigrette. Cereal. Pumpkin oats. Pumpkin everything. A nearby shelf stocker named John says now Halloween has just become pumpkin season.
And then that's like when it goes all crazy. Like, at one point we had 67 items in the store that were pumpkin flavored.
Pumpkin is pretty much over now, but never fear. Companies are signaling the coming of winter with a whole new series of flavors.
salted caramel, you'll have pecan pie flavors. I'm seeing peppermint patty flavors and sugar cookie and dark chocolate cognac.
Market analyst Robert Eckerd says smoke and mezcal will also be big this holiday season. He says companies have been playing with seasonal flavors for decades. But now chain corporations can afford to hire specialized flavorists who concoct powerful and addictive tastes. Eckerd says flavoring has grown to a $2.7 billion industry, and seasonal drinks are a big part of it.
I kind of like to call it liquid desserts or holiday in a glass.
While corporations can giveth, they can also taketh away. Starbucks PR rep Linda Mills says the company was going to stop serving its eggnog latte at certain locations this year. Then it got flooded with letters saying that was naughty, not nice.
We miss our eggnog latte. You know, holidays just won't be the same without our eggnog latte. Please bring it back, whatever you do.
It's a new tradition, the commercially developed, imitation-flavored holiday beverage. In San Francisco, I'm Sam Harnett for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out, continuing with our partial theme today of commodities and crops and also Thanksgiving. Facing pressure from the Congressional Cranberry Caucus, that is a real thing, by the way, that I am not making up, the Department of Agriculture says it has decided to buy $55 million worth of cranberries to reduce a huge market surplus and the attendant falling prices. That'll get the federal government 68 million pounds of cranberries and cranberry-related products, which will go to food pantries and other low-income food programs. And with that, we are out of here. The Dow up 12 points today, less than a tenth percent. The NASDAQ added 29.6%. The S&P 500 put on 5 points. That's a quarter percent. Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Michael Raphael, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Risdahl. I'm off tomorrow and Friday. Lizzie O'Leary is in charge. See you then. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.